The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Mr. Constitution Hour with Douglas V. Gibbs, a broadcast that examines our ever-changing world through the lens of the United States Constitution. Douglas V. Gibbs is on the air.
Hello, my friends. Douglas V. Gibbs here, Mr. Constitution. This is the Mr. Constitution Hour on K-Praise. And let's get started with a story that caught my attention. The United Nations is targeting the Constitution of the United States. The headline of this article, UN Report Condemns U.S. Let me read a little bit of it and we'll talk about it. The latest report issued by the UN Human Rights Council demands that the United States crack down on free speech, change the Constitution, and allow more abortion, while praising the Biden administration for supposedly making progress, bringing the United States in compliance with United Nations agreements by promoting abortion, gun control, and transgenderism. The UN Human Rights Bureaucracy released a scathing report last month, slamming America as a bastion of horrors. In the UN crosshairs, free speech rights, state-level restrictions on killing babies, state efforts to protect children from genital mutilation, and the use of the death penalty on murderers. All that and more came under attack by the UN human rights machinery as supposed human rights violations. The global organization often called for the United States to change its constitution to comply with UN schemes. The controversial UN report released by the UN Human Rights Council on November 3rd examined whether government at all levels of the United States were complying with the largely unconstitutional commitments to the UN International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, ICCPR. The global agreement, ratified by the U.S. government in 1992, purports to commit the U.S. government to usurp a broad array of powers that were never delegated to it in the Constitution that created it. All right, so here's the thing. The Founding Fathers worried about what they called international polities. During the Virginia Ratification Convention, this came up. There was a concern that treaties would try to overpower the Constitution, to supersede the Constitution. James Madison in the Virginia Ratification Convention explained that from a constitutional standpoint, that was illegal because in Article 6, it says that the Constitution is the supreme law of the land. So while treaties are constitutionally supreme law of the land, according to Article 6, nothing can supersede the Constitution. So no treaty, no agreement, no organization, no international polity can supersede the Constitution. And that's what we have here. This is what the UN Council is calling for, is for international law, their UN garbage, to supersede our Constitution, for us to change our Constitution to abide by their wishes. That's like today's culture saying that we don't have to change to the Bible. The Bible needs to change to us. And that's just not the way it is. It's not the way it's supposed to be. So that's the problem there. So as we see the United Nations do this, international polities try to take over our sovereignty, what we need to do is recognize that they are not in our best interest. These are enemies of the Constitution. These are enemies of the United States. I have been advocating for a very long time. It is time for us to leave the United Nations. We shouldn't have been in the first place. The United Nations global organization that with laws and ideas and councils that think that they should supersede a country's sovereignty and a country's constitution, this is something we have no need to be a part of. So that's the article I would like to start with. That's the story I'd like to talk about to this morning. Good morning. My name is Douglas V. Gibbs, Mr. Constitution. We have a lot to talk about today, and I appreciate you joining me here on K-Praise or any of the podcast platforms or right there on DouglasVGibbs.com later on once it's there. And what has happened over time is that the United Nations has morphed from being an organization that was designed or supposed to be for the for greater world cooperation, and has become this body that strategizes for world governance, globalism, something that, you know, conspiracy theories are made of, and now they're becoming today's headlines. And I suppose you could say that in this country, there's this fifth column that's committed to subverting our sovereignty. You have the Biden administration leading that right now. And, you know, it is for us as Americans to, of course, defend American sovereignty. And President Trump defended American sovereignty when he withdrew us from the Paris Climate Accords. And that was, you know, of course, when it came to those who were seeking global control and so on and so forth, why, that was horrific to them. And so they, of course, reacted as you would expect. And word sovereignty is not something that tends to leap off of the speech notes of most politicians. Conservatives have been accused of being, for lack of a better word, isolationists. And that is not isolationism. It means that we're not going to allow the rest of the world to dictate what we do, what we, you know, our distinct right of a people to write our own laws, to define and defend our own borders, and maintain our own traditions without outside interference. That's what American exceptionalism is. We're unique and we're outside all of that. And, you know, it doesn't suggest necessarily that there's a superiority of our people, but that we are sovereign and that we should be able to make our own choices. And that is what was established by our Constitution in the first place. Constitution supersedes everything else. It is the supreme law of the land. So the fact that we should, and earlier when I said this, and we should withdraw from the United Nations, once again, I'm not calling for isolationism. I'm calling for us to make sure that we exercise our sovereignty and that we don't allow, you know, the rest of the world to turn against our sovereignty and characterize us as some, you know, province of a larger world order. And ultimately, what we're watching the world do is head in some Hitlerian, you know, fascist, communist style of system, but on a worldwide basis. Thanks, but no thanks. Our Judeo-Christian ethical values, our legal system, our spiritual foundation, our own prosperity based on our own free market and our own activities, economic activities, our natural rights, our respect for individualism, private ownership of property, belief in autonomy, personal responsibility, pull yourself up by the bootstraps and let's do this as an American attitude, commitment to liberty and justice for all. This is a unique and successful, you know, foundation for this country. And it's been working all along, and for a bunch of globalists to come along and demand that we abandon all that so we can, you know, grab hold of a socialistic, proven to fail throughout history over and over and over idea, especially through their sustainable development garbage. You know, as a country, that is for us to decide, and we don't have to be a part of it. We don't need to be a part of it, and we're better off if we're not a part of it. This Universal Declaration of Human Rights and this 2030 agenda of sustainable development, they can keep it. The idea of all of this is for them to place their thumb on our own individual sovereignty and what we can or can't do, and that some international court somehow is going to dictate or maintain what we're allowed to do. And I'm sorry, that's just not what our system was set up to be. We are, once again, a successful country. We have prospered because of our sovereignty, because we have decided we don't want to play the game the way everybody else does. We are exceptional. We're exception to the rule. We do things the way Americans do things. And, you know, and if ever there was a country that protects human rights and promotes, you know, a fair and environment for people to seek opportunity, it is the United States. All these countries that are dominating the United Nations, if ever there were violators of human rights, it is them, not us. And for them, for the blue helmets and UN, you know, knuckleheads to try to say that we are the ones that are not the ones that are adhering to human rights and civil rights and all that jazz, it's complete poppycock. So when we, as a country, became a constitutional federal republic. Once again, this was a concern. What we're seeing was a concern. That's the reason why there was the Anti-Federalist Papers, the Federalist Papers, and all these arguments and all these debates, ratification conventions, and once again, in the Virginia Ratification Convention, this possibility of treaties and international polities superseding our Constitution or trying to take away our sovereignty, control what we were doing individually outside of the world of empires. Remember, that's what we were in at the time, was a world of empires. That is what the concern was. So once again, it is completely constitutional for us to say, UN, stick it. We're not going to follow your mandates. We are not going to follow your global control. And we're going to leave the organization. How long do you think it would take for the UN to collapse once we removed ourselves from it and we removed our funding from it? It would collapse in a day. And yet they're going to try to dictate to us, but they exist because of us. But once again, our sovereignty is more important. Our individualism is more important. And our American way of doing things is more important, and that's what we need to stick to. All right, thank you for that opening salvo, listening to the open salvo. Let me take a real quick break, and then we'll come back, and we'll get started on Article 1, Section 1 of the United States Constitution right after this. Hi, this is Douglas V. Gibbs, advocate for restoring the Constitutional Republic and host of the Mr. Constitution Hour on K-Praise, San Diego, 9 p.m. Saturdays. Attacks against liberty around the world are increasing. The enemies of liberty have infiltrated the halls of government, and they have conquered every institution we need to restore the biblical and constitutional foundation of America. Leftism is putting the squeeze on our liberty and personal well-being. It's not hopeless. I have been planting strategy information and establishing tactical hubs around America. Faith, education, advocacy, restoration. Check out my books, including my latest, Repeal Democracy. Listen to the Mr. Constitution Hour on Saturday nights at 9 p.m. on K-Praise and become a $9 per month patron at douglasvgibbs.com. Help fuel the movement that has the anti-liberty left on the run. Go to douglasvgibbs.com. Click join, click patron, become a member of the movement. Let's work together on the strategies to save America. douglasvgibbs.com. Douglas V. Gibbs here, Mr. Constitution. You know, I spent 20 years in the construction industry, and now that I'm no longer in the industry, I still feel like I'm always building. But instead of building homes or doing the things that make a home larger or better, I'm doing it with the constitutional education endeavor that I'm involved in. So we are currently building and enhancing what we do. All we need is help from you. Let us know what you think of the website as it grows. Send us an email at douglasvgibbs@ilj.com, or if you want to help fund our efforts, you can go to douglasvgibbs.com or politicalpistachio.com and hit the donate button and contribute to the effort. We want to make this as big as possible. We want to get the word out about the Constitution. We want it to spread to all the minds in this country so that we can turn this back around, restore our republic, restore our Constitution, and be back on the right footing. douglasvgibbs.com, politicalpistachio.com. The Constitution Association's website is at constitutionassociation.com. Constitution Association believes that the Constitution is the solution and the real hope for America. Be a hero in America's story. Make a difference. Protect, preserve, promote, restore the Constitution. Reclaim the Republic. Make America constitutional again. constitutionassociation.com. We are a 501c3 nonprofit organization. All right, my friends, welcome back. And Article 1, Section 1 of the Constitution is where we're at. We're going through the Constitution again on this program. This will be the third time we've done it. You can listen to old episodes. We've done other things. We're also going through history. So at the latter part of this show, the last segment, we're going to spend some time also talking a little bit about history. Last week, we began with the preamble. If you missed it, go back. You can iHeartRadio or Odyssey or go on the KPRZ.com page. There's a podcast, you know, page for that, or you can just go to douglasvgibbs.com radio band. You can find it there. So we are going through the Constitution once again, line by line, word by word. I am Mr. Constitution, Douglas V. Gibbs, douglasvgibbs.com, politicalpistachio.com. Article 1, Section 1. Article 1, Section 1 establishes the legislative powers of the system. With our three branches of government, there are three types of powers. There are legislative powers, executive powers, and judicial powers. The legislative powers is the ability to make law, modify law, or repeal law. Executive powers are the power to execute the law. A president's execution of the law is supposed to be in regards to law that exists. He can't make laws up as he goes. And then the judicial branch's job is to apply the law to the cases they hear. And then so once again, you have different powers with the three different branches, separation of powers. They uniquely have their powers. They don't share them with the other branches. There is some check between the branches, but we have to also remember that when it comes to checks and balances in place, also the voice of the people, the voice of the states, all of that is also a part of the check and balance system. So here's what it reads in Article 1, Section 1. All legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in a Congress of the United States, which shall consist of a Senate and House of Representatives. Let's break it down. All legislative powers, all, the word all means all. I know that's amazing. That's a shocker because politicians will tell you words mean something other than what they are or what their definition is supposed to be. But in the case of all means all. So when it says all legislative powers, that means all ability to make law, modify law, and repeal law only belongs to Congress. It doesn't belong to any other branch of the government. And it also says that these powers are granted to the federal government, to the Congress, by the Constitution. Listen carefully to the words. All legislative powers herein granted. Here in this Constitution, granted. If it's not granted, they don't have the power. If the power is not listed in the Constitution, the federal government does not have the authority over it. How many things does the federal government do that's not listed in the Constitution as a power authorized by the document? All legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in a Congress. The vested is a curious word. Vested means granted, but they are not being repetitious here. They're not saying all powers granted shall be granted. They use the word vested for a reason because it adds to the word granted. It gives the word granted a little bit more beef, a little bit more oomph. The word granted means to legally transfer from one party or one entity or one place to another. But the word vested means not only to transfer that power, but to do so, and once that power is received, it's exclusionary. In other words, only that entity has that power. So in other words, all legislative powers being granted to Congress, that means that only Congress has the authorities over legislating at the federal level. And then it means also that it's irrevocable. They can't give it away. They can't just come up with some piece of legislation and say, you know what? We're going to let the president make this law or make these laws. No, you can't give it away. It's irrevocable. Exclusionary, irrevocable. It belongs only to Congress. Only Congress can make law. Only Congress can create something that is legally binding. That brings up executive orders. When it comes to the president writes an executive order. It is not legally binding. It does not say, oh, well, this is a new law. He can't create law. All legislative powers belong to Congress. An executive order is for either dictating down to the lower parts of the executive branch on how we're going to execute the law, or it's a proclamation. And if you know anything about proclamations, proclamations are not legally binding. Why? Because only law is legally binding. So the president says, we're going to have a national day of prayer, which Reagan did. That doesn't mean that everybody by law has to drop to their knees and pray on that day, otherwise suffer the full penalty of law. It's not legally binding. It's a proclamation. Hey, guys, we ought to do this. Thanksgiving proclamation by George Washington wasn't a law that said on Thanksgiving, the day proclaimed, you must give thanks to the Lord or you will be arrested. It's not legally binding. It's a proclamation. Hey, guys, we ought to do this on this date. So all legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in a Congress. All legislative powers, all powers to make law, modify law, repeal law, herein granted, here in the Constitution, shall be vested. It's given. It's transferred. It's exclusionary. It is irrevocable. In a Congress of the United States, which shall consist of two houses. a Senate and a House of Representatives. And those houses are supposed to be different from each other. Two heads are better than one means two different perspectives. If you have two houses that are both democratically voted in, they're no different from each other. Why even have two houses? The purpose of creating a House and a Senate was for those two houses to be different from each other so they could serve as a check and balance against each other, and so that when legislative bills were being presented, it was from a different perspective, being looked at from a different perspective. The Senate is not supposed to be the same as the House. Now, today they essentially are. They're both democratically voted in by the people. The only difference between the two is some of the powers and the fact that one considers themselves to be higher than the other because they are the upper house and they serve for 6 years instead of two. But aside from that, there's really no difference. But originally, there was a difference. The House of Representatives, like day one, as it always has been, is democratically voted in by the people based on districts that are determined by population. That's the way it was on day one. That's the way it is today. The U.S. Senate was not that way. The U.S. Senate was not democratically voted in. The U.S. senators were appointed by the state legislatures. That way, these senators weren't operating in the same manner as those in the House. It was not based on what the constituency demands, what the mob is calling for. Their concern was to make the state happy, to operate in a manner that was in the interest of state sovereignty, state individualism, state protecting the state's rights, and so on and so forth. And if the legislative party back at home in that state changed to a different party and you're serving for 6 years and you got appointed by a Democratic state House of Representatives, and suddenly the Republicans take over 2 years later, guess what? Now you're going to operate making them happy. Ideology wasn't a big deal. It was what was best for the state and what the state wanted. That was the purpose of the U.S. senators. And once again, they're looking at things from a different perspective. While the members of the House are going to look at it from the popular perspective, the senators are going to look at it from a state perspective. And that way, whenever a debate over a bill between the two houses is going on, it's a different perspective. It's not just one rubber stamping the other. It's not a bunch of, doesn't look like a bunch of monkeys in a row just nodding their heads in unison. You've got a different perspective between the two houses, or at least that's the way it originally was. 17th Amendment in 1913 changed that, changed the U.S. Senate to a democratic method of voting. The proposal of that amendment was unconstitutional because in Article 1, Section 4, it says that Congress shall not change the places of choosing senators in any way. This is the full context for your information. The times, places, and manner of holding elections for senators and representatives shall be prescribed in each state by the legislature thereof, but the Congress may at any time by law make or alter such regulations except as to the places of choosing senators. So the very proposal of the 17th Amendment by Congress in the first place was unconstitutional. Congress has no business getting involved with how the senators are being chosen. That was up to the states. And according to the Constitution, they were to be appointed by the state legislatures. Why did they change that? Because, see, tyranny knows that if the states are in the way, it gets in the way of tyranny. But they can easily fool a bunch of voters to vote for who they want. You know, you put enough money behind the right person, they have the right hair, they have the right teeth, they have a great campaign ad with rhetoric that sounds wonderful on the surface, even though it's destructive underneath, the people will vote for that person. State legislatures, not as easy to fool, not as easy to convince to put in your tyrannical buddies. And that's why they had to change it, because they were trying to get better control over the government. So, but originally, once again, the state legislatures were the ones that appointed the U.S. senators. The 17th Amendment, repealing the 17th Amendment, by the way, is at the top of my wish list. We need to get rid of that. That is part of our problem. All right, so all legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in the Congress of the United States and shall consist of a Senate and House of Representatives. Hope that is something that you now understand. Once again, go through your pocket constitution, check it out, or online, or wherever you find your constitutional language. That is the lesson for today on the Constitution. We're going to come back with a little bit of history, so don't go anywhere.
We are the socialists. You will be assimilated. Your individual liberties, personal freedoms, and mental individuality will be added to our own. Resistance is futile.
This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Our records indicate you've been lied to. Welcome to the truth. Douglas V. Gibbs.
All I'm offering is the truth. Nothing more.
You want answers? I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth. You can't handle the truth.
Tired of the lies? Come here for the truth. Douglas V. Gibbs.
Repeal Democracy by Douglas V. Gibbs is finally available. Doug's latest book examines the importance of being a republic, how we can restore a republic, and why democracy is so dangerous. Of all tyrannies, a tyranny sincerely exercised for the good of its victims may be the most oppressive. C.S. Lewis. And that is the very first page that you will see right before Chapter 1 in Repeal Democracy. Repeal Democracy by Douglas V. Gibbs. On sale now. Hi, this is Douglas V. Gibbs, advocate for restoring the Constitutional Republic and host of the Mr. Constitution Hour on K-Praise, San Diego, 9 p.m. Saturdays. Attacks against liberty around the world are increasing. The enemies of liberty have infiltrated the halls of government, and they have conquered every institution we need to restore the biblical and constitutional foundation of America. Leftism is putting the squeeze on our liberty and personal well-being. It's not hopeless. I have been planting strategy, information, and establishing tactical hubs around America. Faith, education, advocacy, restoration. Check out my books, including my latest, Repeal Democracy. Listen to the Mr. Constitution Hour on Saturday nights at 9 p.m. on K-Praise and become a $9 per month patron at douglasvgibbs.com. Help fuel the movement that has the anti-liberty left on the run. Go to douglasvgibbs.com. Click join, click patron, become a member of the movement. Let's work together on the strategies to save America. douglasvgibbs.com. All right, welcome back to the Mr. Constitution Hour here on K-Praise, San Diego's Christian station, AM and FM for North County and San Diego. Okay, welcome back. Douglas V. Gibbs, Mr. Constitution. And if you want to go to douglasvgibbs.com, become a patron, hit the join link in the link bar, $9 a month, and you help fund what I do, the effort that I put forth, all of this that's going on, this movement to get the Constitution, the education of Constitution education, Constitutional literacy spread across this country, pocket Constitutions in the hands of kids in schools, paying for the radio shows, paying for all of the other stuff that I do, the classes and all of that, that takes funding. One way you can help is you can become a patron, douglasvgibbs.com, hit join. It's in the link bar, right? A little star next to it says join in all caps. Hit that and then become a patron. Just follow the directions. Or if you just want to do you want to send a donation anyway, outside of that, you can also go to paypal.com/paypalme/Douglas V. Gibbs. That's paypal.com/paypalme/Douglas V. Gibbs. paypal.com/paypalme/Douglas V. Gibbs. Or if you have Venmo, my identification is Douglas-Gibbs-3. Douglas-Gibbs-3. And then when it asks for the last four digits of my number, just type in 3975. Douglas-Gibbs-3, then 3975. If you have Venmo, if you use Zelle, then you can send it to me at douglasvgibbs@yahoo.com. douglasvgibbs@yahoo.com. Do not send me emails to that email address. You will not get an answer. That is for the purpose of Zelle, douglasvgibbs@yahoo.com. Because we're always, this show is listener-funded and class-funded. In other words, my classes. My other program, same thing. It's funded not by commercials, by people, by ads from sponsors. I do have one sponsor, actually, I should say, on the other program, All-Star Collision in Corona. But other than that, all of it is funded by listeners and myself. So if you want to participate, especially during this holiday season when Christmas is upon us, and that means that I'm not doing classes, so there's no funding coming in from that. To help fund my efforts, you can go to douglasvgibbs.com, become a patron, or you can go to paypal.com/paypalme/douglasvgibbs or Venmo douglas-gibbs-3975 or through Zelle douglasvgibbs@yahoo.com. All right, so now it's time for history. We've been going through my history book, which should be coming out, or at least part one of it should be coming out in the next few weeks. And so we have finished with World War II. We talked about post-war Germany last week, so let's get into post-war America. So after the troops from World War II were welcomed home and the ticker tape parades were finished, opportunities and challenges were already in play. Adjustment to civilian life and adjustment to the post-war and post-depression years was accompanied by an unexpected situation where jobs were abound and there was plenty of money to spend on a large blossoming fountain of goods. After World War II, America emerged as the world's dominant economic and military power. The years destroyed by the Great Depression was extended by the New Deal. Mainstream opinion will tell you that World War II lifted the United States out of the Depression, but that is not accurate. The production of goods during the war was not regarding the things that people needed. Unemployment was only down because a good portion of the population was overseas fighting the war, and those who remained behind were working to keep up with the war effort. In truth, the period saw a dramatic loss of personal material wealth. The New Deal nor World War II brought the Depression to an end. The free market did. After about a year of not necessarily getting the jump start as it was supposed to have, thanks to the war, the economy began to move again when we moved back to normal conditions and uncertainty was no longer a factor. The heavy regulations in place during the New Deal and during wartime were lifted, and entrepreneurs sought to take advantage of the opportunities that were emerging after the storm of depression and war. The new businesses popped up, entrepreneurs took a chance, and consumers participated in the process. Farmers had prospered during the war, not only because the wealthier was much better during the 40s, but was much better during the 40s, but also because of improvements in farm machinery. Food, whether at home or abroad, is always in demand, and during the war, much of it was needed to make sure the boys overseas were supplied. Farming, however, had also shifted away from the South. The Midwest, Plain States, and California Central Valley were now becoming the breadbasket of the world. As a result, a great migration from the South to those regions took place. More than a million newcomers poured into California between 1941 and 1944 due to the war industries in California. Then, after the war, the migration into California increased. In a speech, March 12, 1947, President Harry S. Truman announced a policy also that pledged to provide aid to countries who were in danger of communist takeover, either by internal subversion or external aggression. Soviet geopolitical expansion during the years after World War II became a concern, and the Truman administration was determined to contain communist uprisings. Two such examples arose in 1948 in Greece and Turkey. The policy became known as the Truman Doctrine, which became the foundation of American foreign policy. The speech to Congress that launched the Truman Doctrine has been claimed by historians to be the starting of the date of the Cold War. By 1949, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, was formed. NATO was launched to serve as a collective security system in which the member states agreed to defend each other against attacks by other third parties, namely the Soviet Union. The organization formed with 12 founding members and has been adding members ever since, with the most recent addition being Finland, who joined the alliance on April 4th, 2023. NATO currently has 31 members, 29 in Europe and 2 in North America. Albania, Belgium, Bulgaria, Canada, Croatia, Czech Republic, Denmark, Estonia, Finland, France, Germany. It was West Germany and East Germany until they... it was just West Germany, should I say, until Germany reunified in 1990. Greece, Hungary, Iceland, Italy, Latvia, Lithuania, Luxembourg, Montenegro, Netherlands, North Macedonia, Norway, Poland, Portugal, Romania, Slovakia, Slovenia, Spain, Turkey, United Kingdom, and the United States. So while historians will tell you that Truman Doctrine began the Cold War, the story is more complicated than that. The Cold War was ignited before Franklin Delano Roosevelt was in the grave. For whatever reason, FDR held Joseph Stalin in high regard. During the war, when Germany turned against the Soviets, despite a non-aggression pact with the communists, by default, the Soviet Union became an ally of the Western forces. The Lend-Lease program already had the United States sending aid and supplies to Britain, so once Stalin's Russia became a member of the Allied team, Roosevelt began sending the Soviet dictator all the supplies he asked for, virtually funding the expansion of communism into Eastern Europe that would begin shortly after. March 11, 1942, Roosevelt commented, "I would go out and take the stuff off the shelves of the stores and pay them any price necessary and put it in a truck and rush it to the boat to send to Stalin." 2 years later, February 14, 1944, the same support was still being offered. Roosevelt said, in 1944, "We must therefore continue to support the USSR by providing the maximum amount of supplies which can be delivered to her ports. This is a matter of paramount importance." In general, Americans were skeptical of communism. Four American presidents refused to recognize the ruthless new Soviet regime. Roosevelt, however, disagreed with his predecessors, extending diplomatic recognition to the Soviet Union in 1933. While at the time, Russia did promise to repay at least a portion of what had been sent, Stalin reneged. When Stalin quipped that FDR was popular in the Soviet Union, Roosevelt responded, "A deep love of peace is the common heritage of the people of both of our countries, and I fully agree with you that the cooperation of our great nations will inevitably be of the highest importance in the preservation of world peace." Either Roosevelt had been greatly deceived by Stalin, or he was a willing participant of the deception. Author of FDR Goes to War, M. Stanton Evans, writes, "Roosevelt was enchanted by what he thought was their worldview. Sure, they were sometimes insecure and barbaric, but at heart, FDR thought it was inherently peaceful, seeking the common good that they were. He told his Secretary of Labor, Francis Perkins, it would explain their most mystical devotion to this idea which they have developed of the communist society. They all seem really to want to do what is good for their society instead of wanting to do for themselves. We take care of ourselves and think about the welfare of society afterward." When Germany violated their agreement with the Russians, Roosevelt was delighted to have the Soviets as an ally. He commented on the situation at the time, "I think if I give him everything I possibly can, I ask nothing from him in return, noblesse oblige. He won't try to annex anything and will work with me for a world of peace and democracy." In a letter to Churchill, he nearly repeated the same thing. "I think there's nothing more important than that Stalin feel that we mean to support him without qualification and at great sacrifice." Warnings about Stalin by his experts never seemed to deter Roosevelt from his affection for Stalin. Looking back, it largely explains why Roosevelt remained silent when the German troops were willing to give Hitler over to the United States if Roosevelt had been only willing to give them an honorable surrender and then join Germany in a war against the real enemy, Stalin's Soviet Union. Senator Robert Taft warned the victory of communism would be far more dangerous to the United States than the victory of fascism. There has never been the slightest danger that the people in this country would ever embrace Nazism. But communism masquerades, often successfully under the guise of democracy, though it is just as alien to our principles as Nazism itself. It is greater danger to the United States because it is a false philosophy which appeals to many. Fascism is a false philosophy which appeals to a very few indeed. Churchill warned FDR of Soviet treachery as well, but Roosevelt refused to see the truth, even as the Soviets conquered Poland, Estonia, Lithuania, and Latvia in 1939 and 1940. In 1942, FDR wrote to Churchill, "I know you will not mind my being brutally frank when I tell you that I think I can personally handle Stalin better than either your foreign office or my State Department. Stalin hates the guts of all of your top people. He thinks he likes me better, and I hope he will continue to." In the process, Roosevelt continued to give the Soviets abundant food, guns, and ammunition to fight Hitler on the Eastern Front. The people of Russia received clothing and 4.5 million tons of tinned meat, sugar, flour, and fats from American farms during a time when the federal government was rationing these same goods in the United States. The Roosevelt administration also rebuilt Soviet railroads and sent railroad cars and machine tools. Vice President Henry Wallace commented after visiting Russia in 1944 that he saw American goods everywhere. During that trip, however, what Wallace did not see was thousands of American citizens in Soviet prisons. Some were POWs from the war, and many others were those who went to the Soviet Union as visitors, hoping to help the Russians. Most of them were executed or died in prison. In addition to supplies, Stalin's spy network broke many U.S. secret documents to Russia on the same planes as the goods being sent by Roosevelt. The stolen information assisted the Soviet Union with technology, including building an atom bomb. The United States could have prevented the Soviet army from marching so far west, and Churchill of Britain actually had a plan that would have led the Western Allies to Berlin long before the Soviets would have achieved that aim. Churchill, recognizing Stalin's goal, urged the American and Russian armies to shake hands as far east as possible. Roosevelt was eager to meet Stalin face to face, and in November of 1943 in Tehran, FDR got his chance. The American president believed he could charm Stalin and win him over with almost unconditional friendship, and Roosevelt's letters are full of text revealing FDR's desire to talk with Stalin. A meeting of the minds to have an exchange of views because I need your advice. In April of 1942, a note to Stalin delivered by William Stanley, U.S. ambassador to Russia, said, "The president told me that he was sure that if the two of you could sit down together and talk matters over, there would never be any lack of understanding between our countries." Stalin always made sure when there were meetings that he did not have to meet with Roosevelt and Churchill together. If he had to meet with both of them, Stalin made sure he got private time with Roosevelt first. In Tehran, Stalin convinced Roosevelt not to stay at the U.S. Embassy, but at a Russian compound where Stalin could charm him one-on-one. Roosevelt's room was bugged, and historian Robert Nisbet found that more than a few Soviet servants were observed wearing NKVD, that's Soviet secret police uniforms, under garments of the kind of waiters and roommates and others would normally wear. Stalin met with Roosevelt in private three times before Roosevelt arrived for the general meetings. Suddenly, Roosevelt had changed his mind regarding operations in the Eastern Mediterranean, going against what he and Churchill had agreed upon in earlier sessions. Instead of finishing off Italy, FDR favored moving troops away from the region and Soviet imperial interests, and sending those troops to join the cross-channel attack plan for 1944 and to evade southern France. Churchill did not argue with the converted FDR, but he well knew that this left the Eastern Mediterranean to the Soviets, which would ultimately lead to an annexation of those Eastern European countries to the USSR later on. M. Stanton Evans, in his book FDR Goes to War, comments that American Commander General Mark Clark, who was operating in Italy for the Allies, later lamented FDR's decisions. The weakening of the campaign in Italy in order to invade southern France instead of pushing on into the Balkans was one of the outstanding mistakes of the war. Stalin knew exactly what he wanted, and the thing he wanted was to keep us out of the Balkans. The key to Eastern Europe, however, first was Poland. In 1940, Stalin sent hundreds of thousands of Poles to hard labor camps in Siberia. He also had more than 10,000 Polish officers, the cream of the nation's talent and youth, executed mostly in the Katyn Forest in Poland. The Soviet leaders shot them in the head, trampled the bodies, and buried them in mass graves. In 1943, not long before the Tehran Conference, the mass graves were discovered. Stalin's Soviet Union professed to be startled by the find and then blamed the Nazis for the mass graves full of Poles. Churchill and others investigated the crime, and their evidence clearly pointed to a Soviet massacre. Roosevelt asked for another investigation because he didn't want to believe it, that the Soviets were the guilty party, and if he had to believe it, he would pretend not to. In Roosevelt's final meeting with Stalin before the American president's death, Stalin made clear his desire to insert Soviet communism into Poland, and Roosevelt said nothing against such an action. He cared for Stalin's goodwill more than the people of Poland. Roosevelt also made sure Stalin understood that the United States would not object to Stalin's occupation of the Baltic states. Roosevelt explained he was confident that the people would vote to join the Soviet Union. The Warsaw Uprising in 1944's autumn months began when the Soviets urged the Poles to rise up against Germany's occupying force. The Poles revolted against the Germans in Warsaw, with the Soviet army just outside of Warsaw. The Home Army startled the Germans and seized most of Warsaw, but the Russian army stood still, giving no aid, watching as the German army butchered the Poles and recaptured the city block by block. Churchill frantically called for sending planes and airlift supplies to the Poles, but Roosevelt balked and even rejected Churchill's recommendation that a letter condemning what happened be sent to Stalin. On September 4th, Churchill wrote Stalin directly, "Our people can understand why no material help has been sent from outside to the Poles in Warsaw. Your government's actions in preventing this help being sent seems to us as at variance with the spirit of Allied cooperation." Stalin's army remained in place. FDR muttered some shallow rhetoric, but no action to support Churchill or the Poles was ever made by the Roosevelt administration. Stalin refused to allow any Allied planes to make any airdrops of supplies. And by October 1st, the Polish fighters and 200,000 civilians had been wiped out. Once the Poles were slaughtered, the Soviet army exploded into activity, entered Warsaw, and defeated the weakened German army. With the collapse of the majority of the Polish resistance in Warsaw, the later takeover by a communist government in Poland would largely go unchallenged. Roosevelt's refusal to assist the Poles was never made public so as to not lose any Polish-American votes in the presidential election that was only 1 month away. As Roosevelt was courting Stalin, M. Stanton Evans writes, "Stalin had help from his vast network of spies in the United States, not just Soviet spies, but American spies, most of whom had secretly joined the Communist Party in the United States, CPUSA. More than 300 communist members and supporters had infiltrated the American government and worked on the Lend-Lease and Treasury in the Lend-Lease, the Treasury Department, the State Department, the Office of the President, the Office of the Vice President, and even American intelligence operations. The Office of Strategic Services, OSS. These spies not only relayed information to the KGB, they constantly tried to shift U.S. policy in a pro-Soviet direction. The opening of the Soviet archives in 1995 revealed the extensive espionage network that effectively operated inside the U.S. government. The Communist Party USA launched in 1919, but serious infiltration began in the 1930s. They supported FDR's recognition of the Soviet Union and embedded themselves in America's bureaucracy with experience working for the Agricultural Adjustment Administration, AAA, the National Recovery Administration, NRA, and the Treasury Department. Writings of former spies Whitaker Chambers and Elizabeth Bentley reveals how state documents were copied and microfilmed and delivered to Soviet government leaders. By World War II, these spies were well positioned to influence policy or at least explain policy, just in time for Roosevelt to embrace Uncle Joe, Joseph Stalin, as his buddy. Stalin, with his spies and Roosevelt following his every request, planned his tactics carefully and successfully. Spy and London School of Economics educated economist Lachlan Curry had direct access to Roosevelt during the 1930s and during World War II. In June 1944, Curry enabled the New York KGB, cabled the New York KGB that Roosevelt was willing to concede half of Poland to Stalin, and that FDR was willing to pressure the Polish government in exile to cooperate with the Russians. According to H. Stanton Evans, Harry Dexter White operated in the Treasury Department, passing information to the Senate during the 1930s and was influential in the hiring of at least 11 communists into the Treasury Department, including Lachlan Curry. During World War II, White influenced tax policy and foreign policy as Assistant Secretary of the Treasury. Historians have uncovered 15 KGB messages that White sent to Russian intelligence officers late in the war. White told the Soviets that Roosevelt would give only limited backing to the Polish government in exile and would not resist the Soviet Union if it decided to annex Latvia, Estonia, and Lithuania. After Roosevelt died, White met with key Soviet intelligence men and told them the Soviets could press for veto power in the newly created United Nations because Truman and Stettinus want to achieve the success of the UN conference at any price. And we're going to stop right there. There's more to go into, so we'll pick up where we left off next week. Thank you for spending the time with me. United we stand, combined we kick butt. God bless America. Friends, God bless you. Remember, DouglasVGibbs.com. Hit the join button link. Become a patron. $9 a month helps fund everything I do. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time here on K-Praise, KPRZ.com. K-Praise, the Christian station in San Diego County. I am Douglas V. Gibbs, Mr. Constitution. We'll see you next time. Thanks for listening.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.